Hey there, constant listeners. It's Nick, and I've got a first here at the start of episode 171 in the history of the far middle. Got some crow to eat before we start rolling with the episode. You see, I had to tape episode 171 a bit ahead of schedule than normal due to travel demands, and you're going to hear the upcoming sports dedication that focuses on a dichotomy of sorts in the world of baseball and pitching. And I'm talking about, in part of the dedication, how Blake Snell won two Cy Young Awards, but he never threw a complete game as a pro. Now, you talk about timing that is bordering on freaky. The day after I taped this episode that you're about to hear, Blake Snell goes out, and not only does he throw a complete game, but he throws a no-hitter. Yep, he did it as a Giant against the Reds, again, despite never pitching a complete game during his nine-year Major League Baseball career before early August in that no-hitter. So his first career no-hitter was also his first career complete game, and he's in his ninth Major League Baseball season, so he's gone a while without throwing a complete game, and his longest outing before this masterpiece that he threw in Cincinnati was only 7 2/3 innings. So your humble host asks in advance for the forgiveness of Blake Snell with the upcoming sports dedication that you're about to hear. I wanted to just inject this intro for you to put it in perspective. It's become, I suppose, another piece of far middle history that we just made. Okay, let's roll with the episode. Hear that? You know what it's the sound of. It is the sound of the start of another far middle podcast episode. Also happens to be the sound of your host here, Nick Deolius, bringing you this toward the end of August. The theme of this episode might most be aptly named Things That Make You Go, Hmm. Now, remember that hit single from the early 1990s? Maybe more on that later. Anyway, we're going to focus on a handful of connections. That's our tradition here on the far middle. But ones this episode that make you go, Hmm. And we're going to start right off the bat with our sports dedication, pun intended, because the sport is baseball. And by the way, all the connections today that make you go, Hmm, will have a pun attached to them. So this is going to be a multidimensional entertaining episode this week. Here's an amazing pair of comparative pitching facts that have me scratching my head and, yeah, making me go, Hmm. The combo consists of two pitchers. Now, one's a legend from the 70s through the 90s, and the other one is a current ace. And what makes me scratch my head about these two is that one amazingly never won a Cy Young Award, and the other has already won not one, but two Cy Young Awards. But if I gave you the objective breakdown of the two, gave you their statistics over their career, etc., the details, so to speak, you never would pair the pitcher with the one who won the award twice and the one who was denied winning the Cy Young in his career. You'd switch them, actually. Allow me to explain. And I'm going to start with the pitcher who never won the award. He was a prior far middle dedication subject, and you might have heard of him, even if you are only a passing baseball fan, because his name is Nolan Ryan. That's right. Nolan Ryan pitched for 27 years and didn't win a Cy Young. The closest he came to winning one was in 1973, when he finished in second place in voting to the winner Jim Palmer of the Orioles. And Ryan finished that season with 21 wins and 393 strikeouts. He finished his career with 324 wins and 5,714 strikeouts. And he led the league in strikeouts 11 times. 11 years he did that. Pitched seven no-hitters, over 5,700 strikeouts. But you know what? Not a single Cy Young Award. Might be the greatest oversight in baseball history. But now let's go to his alter ego, a current ace pitcher in the major leagues. His name is Blake Snell. And if you haven't heard of him, even though you have some degree of interest in baseball, it's not surprising, because he's a pretty unassuming pitcher. Despite that, he's not won the award just once, but he's won two Cy Young Awards, which is noteworthy. But here's what is noteworthy to the point of amazing when it comes to Blake Snell and his pair of Cy Youngs. He has never pitched a complete game. In fact, he's never even thrown a single pitch in the ninth inning as a pro. Now, how does a starting pitcher win not one, but two Cy Young Awards and never throw a complete game in his career? It's an illustration of how much the sport of baseball has changed. Think of it this way. That 1973 season, when Nolan Ryan came in second in the Cy Young voting to Jim Palmer, Nolan Ryan threw 26 complete games that season, 26 in a single season. That's more than most current starting pitchers will throw in an entire career. I did some quick internet research preparing for this episode. I saw that the current active player who holds the record for career complete games, Justin Verlander, at 26, which Nolan Ryan did in a single season in 1973. Again, amazing how much the game has changed. Nolan Ryan hurled 222 complete games in his career. In that 1973 season, he pitched 326 innings. It's a true definition of a workhorse. Blake Snell, in both of his award-winning seasons, pitched only 180 innings each season. That's not exactly workhorse levels. And I'm not hating on Blake Snell. He is a phenomenal pitcher, and I'm not even critiquing him winning the award twice because, once again, today's game is calling for exactly what he delivers on the mound. And frankly, I don't know who would have been more deserving because this has been an evolution that is systemic across all starting pitching. No one throws complete games anymore. So we dedicate episode 171 of the fabulous Far Middle to what I will call the nuttiest compare and contrast that you're ever going to find in baseball. The legendary Nolan Ryan never winning the Cy Young Award, while Blake Snell pockets two of the awards, and he never pitched a complete game in his career as a starting pitcher. A pair of baseball facts, two that make you go, And I thought you'd enjoy that dedication. And if I am not mistaken, we discussed the topic of how a complete game in baseball has become a remnant of the past on a prior Far Middle. But the opportunity to highlight the Nolan Ryan and Blake Snell contrast was too good to pass up, and I'm glad that we got that one in. Let's get rolling with our connections. Nolan Ryan, he starts his professional baseball career as a New York Met. So we're going to make a connection from his not winning a Cy Young Award, making a scratch our head, to what's going on in a land of where many a Mets fan can be found, the Garden State, New Jersey, and specifically the state of public transportation in Jersey. New Jersey Transit is going off the rails. That's pun number two of this episode, by the way. And constant listeners know that I am a longtime critic of public transportation systems and how they bilk taxpayers out of billions of dollars and deny customers adequate service that's worthy of the cost on a consistent basis. Public transit is a great example of how government and inept policies can take what's working without the intervention and make it into a dysfunctional, broken, on the verge of bankruptcy mess. So it's not a new topic that we're exploring here, but I promise you, the specifics with New Jersey public transit are going to shock you. They are exceeding any prior levels of value destruction that we've discussed in the realm of public transit. Now here's the lowdown. New Jersey's transit system, including the linchpin of the system, which are the trains, they have a house of cards financial situation. And the crisis, which it is, was created by inept state government. Since 1990, and that's a long time, New Jersey Transit has diverted from its capital fund, which was earmarked for taking care of things like tracks and trains, and it was diverting money from its capital fund to cover operating costs, and basically mortgaging tomorrow for the benefit of filling funding gaps today. Now, when you hear operating costs, that's always going to be code for wage hike increases for employees. New Jersey Transit is no different. It has more than 10,000 employees. So we're talking about a lot of operating cost to cover. But at least those operating cost gaps are going toward paying everyday employees. However, the spending problems don't stop there. New Jersey Transit recently saw fit to spend $440 million to lease an office building. That's right, $440 million for a building lease. And we wonder why there is a financial crisis looming with New Jersey Transit. Meanwhile, ridership, it's below where it was pre-pandemic, and that hurts revenues, which makes the budget situation more exacerbated. A Band-Aid, albeit a massive one, was gifted to New Jersey Transit by the federal government via pandemic aid. The New Jersey Transit received $4.5 billion, and that allowed it to plug a couple of years of deficit spending caused by declining revenues because of lower ridership and those increased operating costs. But the problem is that all of the $4.5 billion will be spent by the end of this fiscal year, and it still won't be enough this year to avoid a deficit for New Jersey Transit. So that's where the New Jersey governor comes into the act. He signed a budget this summer that is going to place a 2.5% surtax on corporate income above $10 million, and that will be on top of the current New Jersey top corporate tax rate of 9%. Those corporations that are affected by the surtax and for the already egregious 9% tax, they're going to directly or indirectly pass that on to consumers. The governor can call it a corporate tax, but in the end, it's going to be a tax on all New Jersey residents sooner or later. And the situation gets shadier because this surtax doesn't even need to be fully dedicated to New Jersey transit. First year revenue will go to the state's general fund, which means the last place you would see it being invested would be for the equipment and the maintenance of the New Jersey transit system. Now, why is the surtax revenue going to the general fund? Because New Jersey state finances, they are in worse shape than New Jersey transit's finances, if you can believe that. Yeah, New Jersey is projecting to spend $2 billion more than what it takes in as revenue. One lawmaker called the shell game being played with corporate surtaxes being justified in the name of fixing New Jersey transit, but really being used to plug the state's overall budget deficit. Here's how a lawmaker described it. They're going to fix New Jersey transit with this, except they're not. That's a great way to summarize it. And the governor supported New Jersey transit by increasing fares 15% this summer to help plug the deficit. And fares will increase each year after that, and that's going to hit consumers and commuters directly and riders on New Jersey transit. They already pay the highest commuter rail fares in the United States. And there you have it, constant listeners. New Jersey's public transit system, starving investment into equipment and infrastructure, spending $440 million on a building lease, budget deficits, 15% fare increases on what are already the highest fares in the nation, reduced service, and degrading reliability. Cumulatively, things that make you go, The next connection is going to take us just across the Hudson River over to New York City. You might recall from prior episodes that we discussed congestion pricing, whereby New York City was going to start charging $15 to people in cars and $35 to trucks that drive into Manhattan south of 60th Street. And it was set to start June 30th this year. The idea originated back to then Mayor Bloomberg in 2007, because he felt New York City taxing its drivers would make it more, and here's that magic word, sustainable. The governor of New Jersey, Governor Murphy, that same governor who was leading the charge with New Jersey transit tax machinations that we just discussed, he hates the idea of the congestion tolling in New York City because he understands that it will disproportionately hit New Jersey residents who have to work in New York City. Ironic to see the governor of New Jersey so eagerly squeeze commuters in-state, but then be a champion of defending commuters from getting squeezed just across the state line. Well, the governor of New Jersey doesn't have to worry, at least for the time being, because the New York governor is pumping the brakes on congestion pricing in New York City. And in case you missed it, or you're keeping score, that is indeed the third pun of this episode for the third connection. Now, the New York governor is suspending or halting congestion tolls because she says that she's concerned about the rising cost of living in New York City, and that she's also concerned that Manhattan, which still faces a commercial vacancy rate of over 20%, is going to suffer further degradation in commercial occupancies if that congestion pricing and those tolls are implemented. The governor said about her suspension of the congestion tolls, quote, "Given these financial pressures, I cannot add another burden to working and middle-class New Yorkers or create another obstacle to our continued recovery." Yeah, that's great to hear from the governor of New York. And like New Jersey Transit, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority in New York City and the governor of New York, they promised that the congestion tolls would be used to help fund mass transit improvements, which totals somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 billion when you add up the wish list. And that's for every year into the foreseeable future, mind you, not just a one-time $15 billion. Yikes. That's why I said help fund, right? Which is different than fully funding, when you're talking $15 billion every year. No level of congestion pricing would fully fund that. And the Metropolitan Transportation Authority is in crisis, just like New Jersey Transit is. Driver traffic on bridges and tunnels in New York City have returned to pre-pandemic levels, but weekly average subway ridership is only two-thirds of 2019 levels. People don't want to use public transportation in New York City, and they're not doing so. A sort of funny aside was what the New Jersey governor was doing to delay or kill the congestion tolling in New York City before the suspension was announced by the New York governor. The New Jersey governor wanted the federal government to conduct a more complete environmental impact study on the plan for congestion pricing and tolls. Yes, his plan to avoid the congestion tolls in New York City was to engage in lawfare and endless permit review and regulatory oversight by the federal government. And by the way, the environmental review that was done for the congestion tolls was already, get this, 45,000 pages in length. 45,000 pages. Can you believe that? My goodness. No wonder nothing gets done or built in this country anymore. Instead, things just infinitely get litigated and perpetually reviewed by bureaucrats. And there is another interesting sidebar about the term itself, congestion tolls. And not so much a sidebar, perhaps, as a core flaw, because that term, congestion tolls, it infers that it will solve a problem, the problem being gridlock on Manhattan streets. And when you back up on the logic further, the inference is that there are too many cars and trucks driving around Manhattan. So classic economic theory would say tax the activity to the level where it pairs back to where the gridlock is eased, and then use the proceeds to fund public transportation so that there is an added benefit to the effort and the congestion eases further. Now, that's a swell justification on its surface, but it's total nonsense because you have to go back and understand where the gridlock is coming from. Traffic congestion in Manhattan, it's a serious problem. In May, the average speed of a vehicle was 4.5 miles per hour. It creates a lot of lost productivity. But the problem of congestion is not from too many drivers on the road as much as it is from the constraints that have been intentionally imposed upon the infrastructure. Single lane restrictions because of perpetual construction. Bike lanes, they are a killer to smooth flowing traffic. Bus only lanes are worse. Restaurant sheds on sidewalks and into streets, they came into vogue during pandemic, at least for those restaurants that were fortunate enough to survive lockdowns. Those restaurant sheds, they crimp driving lanes. Intentional traffic flow slowing with extended red lights. That's usually marketed under the creative title of traffic calming. On and on the list goes as to why congestion on New York City streets has become maddening. And the answer is not to tax the drivers that you've already tortured with your policies and tactics. The solution is to reverse those policies and practices that purposely bring traffic to a halt. Drop the bike lanes, open up bus lanes to vehicle traffic besides buses, and let traffic flow smoother. No need for congestion pricing and a congestion toll. Drivers will be better off, which means businesses will be better off, which means New York will be better off. But unfortunately, New York City already spent $700 million preparing for the congestion tolls. Over half $1 billion went to install tolling cameras, which are already up. $30 million went to a customer service center, and that's going to require 100 bureaucrats to oversee the tolling. Proponents of the congestion tolling estimate that more than 600 people were involved in the planning and approval efforts to date. Big government bureaucracy at its finest. And I might add that New York voters supported the governor's decision to put congestion pricing on hold by a 2-to-1 margin compared to those who opposed the suspension. Think the polls might have had anything to do with the governor of New York's decision on congestion pricing? Just saying that the coincidence, it just might make you go, Let's jump from the New York City's congestion tolls on vehicles to the topic of where a lot of those commuters are driving to, which is to their jobs in the job market. a lot of head scratching as to what the true state of the job market is, especially with the demand side with employers and job postings. Now, why do we see so many postings for jobs in places like New York City, and yet Manhattan suffers such high vacancy rates? Did those commuters on public transit and in personal vehicles lose their drive to engage in meaningful work? Oh, there it is, pun number four for this episode. Or instead, are all those job postings we hear about and see online, maybe they're not legit? It's a common disconnect that's raising questions across the nation in all the different major markets, and it's starting to make people who track the job market go, hmm. So let's take a closer look. There was a survey performed by an outfit known as Clarify Capital. The survey covered over 1,000 hiring managers and found that one-third of professionals surveyed, they admitted that they use what is known as ghost posts to create an image of a growth company or to placate employees who feel overworked. Sort of creates the optics that helps on the way. The concept of ghost posting for job openings where there's no actual intention to hire, it's not new. And there are several reasons why the practice might be used across corporate America. So let's go through some of those potential reasons. So in places like the tech industry, it's critical to be able to portray an image of growth. And having a lot of job postings that are publicly available and viewable, that helps create a veneer of a company that is expanding. And that can be important for things like share price, if the company is publicly traded, or IPO prospects if the company hopes to go public. And it might also border on running counter to Securities and Exchange Commission rules regarding stock manipulation and misleading investors. But that's another issue altogether. Another benefit, potentially, of ghost posting is giving the impression to existing employees on the team who feel overworked. As I said earlier, help is on the way. And if they just keep plugging, they just keep pushing, the workload will relent and the addition of the new hire will help alleviate the pain. But of course, the new hire never materializes because it was a distraction to placate the current team, at least in the short term. Not very transparent or healthy for culture in the long term. And then there is maybe the most obvious or widespread reason for ghost posting. It's a way for the Human Resources Department of a corporation to keep a current pool of candidates across different disciplines if and when the need to fill that position arises. It's a way to keep, you know, your finger on the pulse of human capital in your industry. And the problem with that, of course, is that you're misleading the interested party or worker when you warrant to them that you're ready to hire, when really you're just fishing to gather market intel for maybe a decision to hire down the road. That would be disingenuous. Now, some of the more skeptical jobs market experts think that another reason for ghost posting is to create an aura of activity and being busy within departments like human resources within corporations to help manage expectations and create the right impression within the company, looking busy so that more scrutiny is not applied to that area or that department. Busy work. Who knows? Perhaps that happens depending on the company. You add up all the potential rationale for the practice of ghost posting, and what you end up with is a situation where a misleading picture of business activity and job demand has superseded the original purpose of job postings, which was to support legitimate job creation and job seekers. We close episode 171, where the theme was connections that make you go, with the hit single from CNC Music Factory titled Things That Make You Go, It was released in the summer of 91, did quite well on the Billboard charts, and CNC was a dance music group and had a couple of hits in the early 1990s. There is a story behind the title of that song. Yes, you might be old enough to remember where the title of the hit song and the theme of our episode came from. CNC Music Factory borrowed it from the Arsenio Hall show. And if you're wondering who Arsenio Hall is, then I bet you're under 40 years old. You have to go to YouTube to figure that out or watch the comedy movie Coming to America. But take my word for it, young constant listeners. Arsenio Hall was a popular late-night talk show host on TV back in the 1990s, way before Kimmel and Fallon. And he had a popular segment on his show where Arsenio, during his stand-up monologue, pondered certain thoughts and referred to them as things that make you go, hmm. And he would place his index finger on his head as if in deep thought while speaking the line. It was a funny segment, and his show was must-see for a good part of the early 1990s. It's hard to believe, but Arsenio is almost 70 years old. Time flies, and so did this episode. Gotta go, but until next week, stay connected to that far middle.